I was with her through 4 months of her death process. It was a difficult experience, of course. I didn't know much what I know now, but it was also something special, something very special for me and for her. We got very close. And when you're with somebody at the end of life and on their end of life journey, it's a very intimate experience.
You're listening to the Woman of Value podcast. You are about to hear the story of a woman who is following her dreams and passions and creating positive change in the world. My guest today is Dr. Sally Gabriel. She is an end-of-life doula, and she's based in Sarasota, Florida. She is passionate about helping people get comfortable talking about planning for death. She has reinvented herself many times as a gerontologist, a banking executive, a nutritionist, and a health and wellness coach. She holds graduate degrees in psychology, finance, and nutrition, plus certifications in coaching and end-of-life work. Welcome to the podcast, Sally.
Thank you, Sandy. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Tell us, what does Woman of Value mean to you, Sally?
Well, one of the first things I would say is that I think that we all have inherent value. We all have inherent worth just because we exist, and it's just a state of being. But I don't know that that's, I think the cultural view of it is something else. So I was thinking about, from a cultural perspective, it's probably like a woman who refers to her, who recognizes your value, recognizes her gifts, her talents, and can use them for good in the world. That's how I would look at it now. And also a woman who loves herself and loves others and can project that out into the world, that confidence.
I love that. And I think this is something that often comes later in life, like we go through life and we don't realize our value. And eventually, yes, and you've recreated yourself so many times, like you start to get closer to your purpose and the meaning that you want to bring to the world, but also why you were put on this earth, you know, and what really lights you up. So that brings me to my next question, which is, how did you get here? What were some of these aha moments that brought you to becoming the woman of value that you are today?
Well, you know, that's such a big question, especially when you've lived a lot of years, right? So I had a couple of things. One, I'm just going to mention very briefly, and then the second one I'll illustrate a little bit more. But the first one, when I was 45 years old, I ended up getting sick and I got chronic fatigue syndrome. I was working in a very high-powered career. I was a finance executive at a bank in Rochester. I was running the finance department. And I had two young babies, a husband, and I just burnt right out. And, you know, we've all heard those stories. I burnt out. I didn't have good self-care. And then I was forced to give up my career. I was forced to start over. So, I mean, that was a huge aha moment for me. I mean, it was not a moment. It was a period of time where I had to reinvent myself in some way. And it took years. It took years. A lot of work. Therapy, body work, just to get better and to get well enough to be able to work again. I chose a career in health. I became a nutritionist. I studied health coaching and lifestyle coaching, and I have been doing health and lifestyle coaching for many years. So that was the first one. But the one that has led me to the work that I'm doing now, the aha moment, as most people, you know, I think that have always had like a discomfort around this subject of death, just because it wasn't a subject that we talked about. And my first experience with, I had grandparents who died, but my first real experience was when my parents became ill. And interestingly, they both became ill in the same year, in 2017. They were divorced, so they weren't in the same place. My father I brought to Florida. My mother was in White Plains, New York. And I ended up kind of caring for both, going back and forth. And I noticed a lot of things while I was doing this kind of work. I mean, just, again, I didn't know much. My mother died in White Plains Hospital, surrounded by no one, on a ventilator. It was not anything that was comfortable for any of us. I don't know how she felt about it. My father was here in Florida, and he had kind of a, well, we did get hospice care for him, but a very agonizing 9 days at the end. And my brother and I were completely clueless about what was happening. Hospice was in and out. We didn't really see much of them. And I started realizing like, oh, this is not, this doesn't feel good. And then a couple of years later in 2021, after, you know, grieving, a friend of mine had asked me, she was dying of a lung disease. And she asked me if I would take care of her. I don't know why I said yes, but I said, sure, I'll do it. Just some voice came out of the blue. I'll do it. And I had already moved to Minnesota. I came back to Florida, took care of her for 4 months, and pretty much acted as what I'm doing now as a doula, as a counselor, and just did some caregiving, but we did hire people for that. And I was with her through 4 months of her death process. And it was it was a difficult experience, of course. I didn't know much what I know now, but it was also something special, something very special for me and for her. We got very close. And when you're with somebody at the end of life and on their end of life journey, it's a very intimate experience. And I didn't know that. And so after she passed away, I was very inspired. I started working with hospice. I joined as a volunteer and eventually went on a year later to become an end of life doula, got certified. And I work with hospice now, and I also have my own business. So that's where I am now.
It's quite a journey. But these little breadcrumbs that brought you there are always interesting. So you were already kind of, after the burnout, you got into health and wellness. So you're already on that trajectory. And then watching your parents die and having it be undignified, alone, agony, pain, and even in hospice care, which usually tries to make your end of life as comfortable as possible, it can be really scary for people. And mm-hmm. and then your friend asks you to help, and somehow you say yes. And and it is this sacred experience, even though it is difficult. And I think this whole topic is so is something people really avoid. They avoid talking about it. They avoid preparing for it. There's this big fear of what's going to happen. How am I going to die? What are the people going to feel like afterwards? There's so many things to think about. Mm-hmm. Can you share with us some of the things you do now as a doula, and what's different about this way of supporting people through death?
Yeah, it's and actually the end of life doula movement, we also are called death doulas. It's fairly new, and it comes from the birth doula movement, which makes sense. And that started many, many years ago. The end of life doula probably started within the last maybe 15 years of being more formal. And it's only maybe in the last maybe five that the programs to train doulas have really stepped up. And the work is different from the end of life workers. For example, hospice is funded by Medicare. So there are only a certain number of hours that hospices can deliver care. My local hospice only sees a patient once every 2 weeks, the nurses. The nurses are the case managers. They don't have the kind of time that a doula can put in. Again, a doula, some of them work with hospice, but if a doula is hired, they're a person that could be hired like a home health care agent. And when they're hired, they can put in as much time as a client needs. So that's the first distinction, is we can put in the time. We're also there to support the client in an emotionally, kind of spiritually. We're not there for medical reasons. We are not a medical person. And that's the point. We're non-medical. And I think at the end of life, and I noticed this when I was caring for the people I cared for, there's not enough emotional support, in the sense that the family, the caregivers, they're going through their own, particularly if it's family, they're going through their own grief. They're going through their own trauma around death. They don't know how to provide the emotional support that perhaps somebody needs. And so we're trained to handle a lot of that, those emotional kind of things that come up. Deal with the difficult emotions. Start the conversations about death. We learn to be comfortable talking about death, talking to people about their fears. Again, meeting them wherever they are. So we let the patient guide us in what they need. That's pretty much what, in a way, that's different. It's a niche. It's a niche field.
The hospice would provide the medical care and you would provide the emotional and spiritual care.
And hospice does have social, they do have social workers. And so many of the hospices are bringing in social workers, but again, their time is limited. Mm-hmm. They can come in maybe once a week, or they're not there to really support in the same way that an end-of-life doula could be. I want to say one more thing that's important. We are there by the bedside. So during the time that a person is actively dying, we will be there as much as we can be, as much as the family wants us to be. And I like to think of us as event planners for the dying. We will plan wedding. It's like planning a wedding. We will plan the entire event for the person and the family. So we try to, again, if people have time, and many people do have time, they'll have a diagnosis and they have some time before they actively die. They can plan what they want. And people aren't used to that. Mm-hmm. You know, planning it like, well, what would you like? Would you like music at the end of life? Do you think who are the people that you want surrounding you? What kind of room would you like? What would you like the room to look like? And of course, the medical piece, people take care of that. How much medicine do you want? Those are the pieces that we wouldn't necessarily do, but we can guide people to get those things done. So it's really about talking about it early and planning for it. Mm-hmm. And the people that have planned and get the most support around dying seem to have the best experiences.
That makes sense. I'm thinking a lot of childbirth, and and I'm sure that comes up when you talk about being a doula. I mean, doulas were not even a thing when I was giving birth, but I remember, so my first child was born 3 weeks late, and I had to advocate for him to not be induced earlier than I felt was necessary. So I was already pushing back on the medical world, but it was all very just medical and, let's make sure that everything is going well. And it did not go well, but that's a whole other story. And then by my fourth child, I decided I wanted to have a midwife because I wanted somebody who was actually going to be there and advocate for me. And she turned out to be a terrible midwife. She was, because she worked for a doctor's office and she was very into intervention and using, medicine that I didn't want to use. And I felt alone. I felt like that's why, having somebody who could have been there where I could have planned and said, this is the kind of birth I want. And because the doctors would show up and just catch the baby, they would be like, well, I'm watching a soccer game. So do I really have to come in? And, I mean, I actually heard that from one of my doctors, he was pissed at me because I made him leave his soccer game, the poor guy. So it was like, after three experiences with this, I said, I want to have somebody who's going to be present with me. And it didn't go according to plan. Had I had a doula, I wouldn't have had a midwife who was talking to my ex-husband in the other room, saying things like, I don't think she's really trying hard enough. I was getting a lot of negative talk, and it was so unhelpful and it was so unkind. And so I can imagine, thinking about death, like if you can prepare. And I mean, we all can prepare on a level, right? Even if we're not diagnosed with something, but we can prepare about the kind of celebration of life we want to have.
Yes.
The kind of people, just like people invite people to a wedding that they don't want to have there because they feel it's an obligation. Like here's this opportunity to just surround yourself with love and comfort and not have people around who drive you crazy and who would be stressful. Yeah. So give us an example of how you've done this for someone, like if you could give us some clear examples.
I'll tell you about the person that I took care of for the 4 months. And she was a Buddhist, so as am I. And so we have learned in many ways through our Buddhist practice to be fairly open about death and dying. So we could talk about it. She was someone who could talk about it. Some of my clients have not been able to really talk about it or acknowledge that they're dying. That's a different story. So this woman, Victoria, was able to do that. So we planned. I mean, she knew pretty much what she wanted. She knew she wanted to die at home. We took care of all the legal pieces, made sure that was done, because that's important. And that's what many people will do ahead of time. They'll have their wills, they'll have their trusts, they'll also have their advance directive, which is not a legal document. So we know who the healthcare proxy is. And very often that's as far as they go. But Victoria went further. You know, we took care of all the medical, the financial, you know, anything related to what people, any of us would need to know when she passed away. Because that's important. You know, how do people get into your computer? Very basic things. Mm-hmm. How do they take care of your financial matters? If you have children, great. But if you don't have children, someone else needs to do that. And then just the planning around what she wanted when in her final days. Because in the end, people can't make those decisions for themselves. And as a doula, we advocate for the patients. So she told me what she wanted. And when the time came, she really didn't want a lot of people around her. And there were certain people she didn't want to talk to. And she didn't want people coming in and out. And then when she was actively dying, I felt like in a way that I was a gatekeeper. Mm-hmm. Who came, who didn't, how the room was set up, quiet. Judging from how she was doing, you know, she was one of her siblings wanted to talk to her on the phone, and I could tell she wasn't quite interested. And that was the end of the phone call. So you know what I'm saying? Your presence by the bedside, advocating for what they want, and they've told you this ahead of time. If I had, like with my parents, I did not know what they wanted. So it was just hit or miss. Other than, again, funeral arrangements, people do that. But all of these little details, we can talk about those things. And by knowing, it made her passing much easier. And it helped me a lot because I knew how to support her. And people often are worried about the medical piece, you know, of not wanting to be in pain. And it is extremely, I want to say easy. It's not always easy in every case. But in most cases, the pain is not an issue. It can be handled. And that's, of course, where hospice comes in.
Yeah. So all the pieces, the logical, the financial, and all those things that are important. I was visiting my mom yesterday. She's going to be 92 in December. Mm-hmm. And she's still very, very much alive. And she's still driving, living alone, walks unsupported. A pretty amazing. And she was saying to me, I have so many pictures. I don't know what to do with them. I have so much, like a lot of her furniture came from her husband who died. And so she's thinking that it'll go to his family when she dies. And I said, you know, most people don't want any of this stuff. Like it's older, it's not, yeah. And his family lives, a lot of them live in other countries and they're not going to take it. And I said, you know, if you don't like it, you could sell it. You know, you could find out if you could sell it now. And I'm trying to be logical, rational. And she's like, oh, it's too overwhelming. I can't do it. But that's the kind of thing where, you know, she goes, well, I don't want to get all new couches and new everything. I said, no, I'm not saying like sell all the furniture and then go get new furniture. That would be silly. But like all the silver and the things that you don't use and the dishes, yeah. And I would imagine that, you know, taking care of you, putting your things in order and taking care of stuff so that you can live your best life now and not think about all this stuff. And also then it becomes a burden for the next generation who then has to take care of it. So how do you help people with stuff like that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And certainly with this client, this particular person, my friend, she was very well aware of all the stuff. And so we did begin, she had places that some of the silverware was going and she had friends who wanted her cookware. So we mailed things out, you know, she was able to do all of that. Mm. And the furniture, you know, basically she said, you're going to take care of selling the condo and you're going to take care of the furniture. She also had a sibling who came and picked things up. So she kind of had arranged that. And I noticed when my mother passed away, it was just a house full of stuff. Nothing was taken care of, nothing.
Yeah.
And it often falls on the children
mm-hmm.
that they have to sort everything out. So it's really wonderful when people can take care of those things. I've actually been working with some patients who are in hospice care and who are already in a facility. So those things have been taken care of, for example, by the family, by emptying the apartments. But I do think that's a big piece of the planning. And doulas, again, while we don't do the work, we can certainly, you know, we might have a long checklist of things that people want to take care of before they go. They also mm-hmm. might want to, how do they want to be remembered? So it's like a legacy, you know, you might want to be remembered. Maybe you want to write your life story. We can help them write their life story. Sort pictures. They might want to sort through their pictures, decide who gets what, you know, there's a lot of things that they feel nostalgic about.
Mm-hmm.
And to provide that space where people can talk about those things, you know, have these conversations by sitting by the bedside and meeting with people as long as possible while they're still able to talk, you know, they can tell their stories. We can record them if they want.
Mm-hmm. I think that's such an important thing.
I started
to record my mother's stories, and my sister was taking care. She was staying with my sister for like a month about a year ago. And I gave my sister a book that had prompts, like the little questions to ask. Right. And she started to just spend some time with her every day. And she would take the notes because it would be too overwhelming for my mother to do.
Yeah.
But recipes, you know, all these things that don't get passed down because people never write them down. You know, a handful of this and a pinch of that. Nobody knows what any of that means. But these are the ways that we remember people. And so that's lovely that you can help people to facilitate that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I just have a new client that I'm working with, a younger person, and who doesn't have children. And she wasn't sure how to leave a legacy. And I suggested maybe writing her life story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could help her write her story because, you know, everyone has a story to tell. Doesn't matter how young or old you are.
If you have ever played small to make other people feel comfortable, or maybe stayed in a bad relationship or job too long because you didn't think you could do any better, I wrote a book for you. It's called Becoming a Woman of Value: How to Thrive in Life and Love. Each of the 30 chapters contains a life lesson, a story, and an exercise to bring you closer to reaching your full potential. Becoming a Woman of Value is available on Amazon in paperback and Kindle.
A lot of people avoid these conversations and they avoid doing all these things because they don't want to think about it. And I think it's so healthy to think about it, to actually deal with it. You know, the couples who one spouse dies and tells the other person what they want for them moving forward, you know, that I want you to move on, that I want you to find somebody else. I want you to have a life. This guy that I was dating who was widowed, his wife told him four rules. First, he worked too much, so he should stop working so hard. And he immediately quit his job. His second rule, I don't remember all the rules, but one of them was he should get out and socialize more because he really was consumed with her and, you know, get out and make new friends. And he did that. He belongs to a lot of different groups right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I just remember the fourth one was that he should get laid. And it was one of the rules. And
got permission.
I mean, he moved on immediately. He just like started dating. And I met him like his wife had her ashes had not been scattered yet. And he was on a dating site. And I was like, when did your wife die? And so, you know, we ended up just becoming friends because he's such a nice person. But one thing he started doing was telling his stories. I introduced him to the moth and he started to become obsessed with the moth stories and he became a moth speaker. And now he belongs to lots of storytelling groups and many of his great stories are about his wife. And so he's
wonderful.
Yeah. Carrying on the legacy.
He's carrying it on. Yeah. I love
that. Yeah. Which is beautiful. Yeah. And something he hadn't even thought about until he met me. So
yeah.
It's there's so many beautiful things people can do. And you and I were talking, we know each other from before, and you were saying something about the Jewish burial tahara, the way that the Jews prepare the body for burial, and that you were going to study that.
Yeah.
If you could share with the audience a little bit about what that is and why you're interested in studying.
Well, I'd love to. It's just that I haven't done the class until I'll start next week. So you probably know a little bit more about the Jewish burial than I do. So I will know by the end of November. I will definitely know more about it.
Well, yeah. So my curiosity is why you wanted to learn it.
I was raised Jewish, and I do have some cultural affinity with Jewish people. And I am interested in the different rituals that occur at the end of life. How what people do with the bodies. And there's so many different ways now besides just burial in the ground and cremation. We learn that cremation is not good for the environment because, of course, the ashes are going everywhere. So people are looking at different ways. Again, this is not exactly your question, but that's preparing the body more, right? Mm-hmm. But also burial, green burials, and we've got new options today.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting to find out what religions, different cultures are doing with people's remains. Mm-hmm. That's an important piece too.
Yeah, I became fascinated with the whole tahara process when my son had passed away and I saw that somebody prepared his body for burial and I had never seen it. I thought, what an incredibly kind act it was and how compassionate to work with a very young child. He was 5 years old and had multiple surgeries. So, just thinking about what it must have been like for them. And I kind of put it aside for many years. And then a friend of mine said, join me. We're going to be doing a tahara. Join me. And I was like, oh, okay. But I was scared. And, coming in contact with people who have died, washing the body, you're saying special prayers, and you're putting on special garments. And it is a sacred practice. And it's not really talked about. It's sort of a secret society where people don't talk about it because it's like the ultimate act of kindness because you don't get thanked for it. You just do it out of the goodness of your heart. And I did it for many years. I don't do it any longer, but there was something very moving about the whole spiritual practice of it.
Yeah, I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
I think also at the end of life, when someone's getting close to the end, what we call the vigil, where active dying begins generally when someone stops eating and there's some physical symptoms that we look for. So we know someone's actively dying. And that's also for me a very kind of a sacred time. Patient may no longer be speaking, but just they usually respond to touch. So to touch them, my father, I actually got in bed and held him because he was so agitated. A lot of times people are agitated, and that's just all part of the process of the body shutting down. And so that sacredness of being touching and calming people's nervous system. And just being at the bedside is also a very sacred practice.
Mm. You're reminding me of one of my closest friends who had lung cancer. She died within just a few months of diagnosis, so four or 5 months. And she was very private, didn't really want visitors. And finally, the day before she died, her husband called me and he said that we're at the end. You can come.
Okay.
And so I drove, it was like an hour away, hour and a half away. And I came to the house and one of the brothers-in-law was standing guard at the door. Who are you? Why are you here? Because they didn't want anybody there who didn't belong there. Because there were people who were really imposing themselves. And I remember that. And I told him that I was invited to come and I came to the door where she was lying in bed and the whole family was around her. And she was very agitated and thrashing around. And I just felt like I didn't belong there. Like this was a really sacred moment for the family. And I as quickly as I came in, I walked out of the room and I just spent time with the family, just comforting them, holding and hugging. But I did, I felt like I was not welcome in that room. Like it was just her mother was standing next to her and holding her. And I just, I couldn't be in that space. So it's a lot. It's, you know,
it is, it's a lot. And I'm, and I think most of us are just not, we're not prepared for that. You know, we don't know, we don't know what to expect. Of course, how would we know? We're not trained and we don't talk about it ahead of time. So it's really important. I think a lot of the education, some, you know, end of life doulas, one of our roles here, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, is education. You know, how can we educate our communities, our world? And it is spreading around the world, of course, but how to be more comfortable around the idea of death and what does it look like? Because our bodies do shut down in similar ways. And it's not medical. This is all just part of life. How to accept this is just part of our life process. And that's a whole different conversation, but it is a conversation that's very important for us to be having.
Well, you mentioned Buddhism, and I know Buddhism has a special take on death. Can you share that perspective?
You know, there's many different, I hate to be a, you know, what's the word, the informant about Buddhism, because there's many different types of Buddhism, and they have each one, maybe the Theravadan is the early Buddhism, and then we have the Mahayana, which is a later phase of Buddhism, and they, and then groups within each of those, and they have different views on death and what happens after death. So the group that I belong to, we don't really even talk about it. We don't know. And the Buddha really didn't, from what my understanding of it, didn't really say exactly. That wasn't where he went with it. But some other groups have gone into the reincarnation issue. And, you know, I just, I don't know. I had a client ask me, the woman that I met with Saturday, she said, well, what do you think happens at the end, you know, after death? And I told her, I don't know. I don't even begin to guess, you know what I mean? But these are the kinds of questions people have, and they're completely natural questions, and people want to, you know, we all have different beliefs. And I think these are important to talk about. These are important topics to talk about. Have you heard yet of the, of Death Cafe? Have you heard of the Death Cafe? There's a movement, and it started, I'm not quite sure when it started in England, to hold group, like a group session, to talk about death. And they, in England, they would have tea, tea and probably, and cake. They love having cake. And whoever started it, again, I'm not going to get the name, kind of patented it, the idea. And it's been spreading around the world. We're going to be doing, we're going to be holding Death Cafe, a Death Cafe here in Sarasota. And I'm going to be able to facilitate one of the sessions where, you know, people just come in to talk about anything related to death. And I'm guessing these kind of subjects will come up. You know, what do you believe about the afterlife? Do you believe that you're, you have a soul? I mean, all of these kinds of questions, nobody's going to be able to confirm it necessarily, but we start talking about it.
Yeah, it's fascinating how different religions and different groups think about death and the afterlife. And I just believe that people need to believe something usually because it makes them feel better about dying. Like, oh, if I'm going to a better place and I'm going to be reincarnated and my soul will enter some other person. And it just gives them a sense of comfort. And it was interesting, like when my son died, I had another son who had been born 8-9 weeks before. And so there was something very similar about the two of them. Like my my baby was, he had a similar composition, like his whole personality was kind of calm and very similar to my other son's. And and there were a lot of correlations. Both of them were very musical. And I had this thought at the time that there was some kind of way that my other son's soul sort of entered into this son. I don't really believe that anymore, but it's nice to have something to believe in when, especially when you're grieving and when you're going through all of that. So
I completely agree. I do think it's very individual. Mm-hmm. You know, again, and what that is, those are questions that we would certainly ask clients, you know, what do you think? You know, what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah.
And certainly many of them have their own chaplains, or they have some religious person that might want to come in and talk to them. You know, we don't do that. Mm-hmm. You bring in somebody who they can talk with about that.
What's important, and what I keep hearing in this conversation, is that you're very open and validating and not judgmental,
right?
And support right. people wherever they are.
That is one of the most important things I learned in my doula training. And you learn that as a coach too. So I have coaching background. Mm-hmm. You really meet people where they are. So for example, if someone isn't accepting, and I do have one person I've been working with, she's still alive. She had a mental disorder. And so she could not, every time I tried to talk to her about planning, she would just shut me down. And this would happen over and over. And I just was like, okay, we're going to leave it at that. So the planning has been done through her family. She has a sister who represents the rest of the family. And all the planning has been done between me and the sister, and of course, hospice. And so my client and I have never really talked about death. Mm. But I go now, she doesn't talk now, and I support her and I help feed her and I do things just to be there, to be the loving presence. She's in a facility and she doesn't have anybody else right there. Mm-hmm. So we provide that, you know, you're the loving presence at the end of their life.
Yeah.
So whatever they need, in a way.
Yeah. So you spoke a little bit about some future projects, like educating people about death and having the death cafe so people can talk openly about death. What else is on tap for you for the future?
Well, I certainly would like to, I'd like to grow my business, but I think, again, as a doula, any of us that are doulas, you cannot take on too many clients personally. So the best thing to do is to form a collective or an alliance in a group, in an area. So I'm in the Sarasota area, and there are three counties that we touch up against. And I have been recruiting other doulas in the county, in three counties. And I've got, right now we have a group of 11 doulas. They're all women, but men do it too. And we're going to I'm looking into forming a collective so that we can work as a team. And for example, if there's a vigil, somebody's dying and they need 24/7 care, you know, not to care, but coverage, one person can't do it. So we could take turns. We could all help each other. So that's the idea of a collective. There are some around the country. Of course, birth doulas have done this for centuries, but death doulas are forming collectives. There's one out in California. I've talked to somebody there, and I'm going to be talking to some other ones. There's one in Philly. And just to find out how they're doing it, we'd like to form one in Sarasota. And as part of that, we're going to be doing education, finding places we can start giving talks. We have a radio station that's going to sponsor a series of death talks starting this week, and it will be going through March. We're going to do the Death Cafe. So we'll be on the radio, not just doulas, but anyone who is involved in end-of-life care. And of course, Sarasota County, you know, Florida, we have lots of people who are elderly, you know, in dying, all of that. It's a Mecca for older people. So we really have the population here. It's just that they don't know about care. People don't know about the gaps in care. So I think when you ask the average person, they just think, oh, hospice will take care of me. Mm-hmm. And no, honey, that's not going to happen. They cannot do that. Hospice relies on the family to take care of people. But some people don't have families. You know, as the boomers get older, lots of us don't, or the families aren't going to take care of us. Mm-hmm. So we don't, you know, that whole end of life thing, it's going to be more and more in the news because the care we have now is not adequate.
Yeah.
And I think these conversations are important to people to go, well, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? You know, we start talking about that more.
Yeah. That sounds great. All right, we're going to go to the lightning round.
Okay.
Are you ready?
All right. Yes.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
Fill in the blank. I used to think I wasn't blank enough.
I used to think I wasn't lovable enough.
Oh, next question. What is the was the number one thing holding you back from becoming a woman of value?
My conditioning. I think, you know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s and was conditioned around all this conventional wisdom that has not served me well. And so that's what's held me back is that conditioning and having to learn, unlearn it all and start over.
Yeah, so much of our learning is unlearning. Next question. What's the best advice you can give to a woman who wants to become more empowered?
You know, watch your self-talk. I don't think we realize how we talk to ourselves. And a lot of times it's not our own voice. It's somebody else's voice, our mothers, our fathers, or some cruel teacher. And we are talking very harshly to ourselves. So I think noticing that and then learning some of the skills like self-compassion. Self-compassion is that tool that for me has changes everything. Self-compassion. Yeah. And then being learning to be compassionate of others, mm-hmm. taking that out into the world. That's a really important skill for women to have more people more empowered.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that self-compassion, it's like one of the things I consistently work with clients on is a self-compassion practice. Having mm-hmm. that practice where you start speaking kinder to yourself, you notice those negative voices, just terrible.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to your younger self?
I struggled as a young person trying to find my place in the world. I didn't feel like I fit into the conventional world. I would have advised myself to find a place to learn meditation, because I think meditation has made a big difference in my life and other people's lives as well. And learning to meditate, finding some sort of inner nourishment. I would have liked to have done that when I was young. That would have helped a lot.
Good advice to your younger self. Sally, what is something people often get wrong about you?
So I work in a serious subject with serious people. People are sad. And I'm pretty intense. So I think people think that I don't have a sense of humor. So I want to say that I do have a fairly decent sense of humor. My family was funny. You know, we learned to laugh quite a bit. My father had a great sense of humor. My brother has a great sense of humor. So I think they don't think I'm funny, but I am.
Yes, it's amazing how people are not one note.
We are extremely complex.
Yes, we are. And finally, Sally, how would you like to be remembered?
I would like to be remembered as someone who has developed certain qualities of the heart. Things like empathy, compassion, kindness, and kind of an ability to love in a way that makes other people feel special. And maybe hopefully pass that along to my children and people that I come in contact with.
I love that. That's really a beautiful, beautiful legacy to leave. And you're absolutely doing the work right now to leave that to so many people.
Thank you so much.
Give us your website.
The website is Epilogue Care, EPILOGUECARE.com. And the business is Epilogue End of Life Care. I'm on Facebook with that name, Epilogue End of Life Care, and then LinkedIn with my name, Sally Gabriel, PhD.
Thank you so much, Sally. This has just been a very moving conversation. It's such an important topic that most people don't talk about, and which is why I wanted to talk to you today
and
shed
that.
Some light on it. Yeah, because it is, if we can normalize these conversations, I think we'd all have better end of life experiences.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you for giving me the chance to talk about it. Oh, it's my passion.
I know, I can feel it. And thanks everyone for listening today. If you love our show, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you would like to step more fully into your value, grab a free copy of The Ultimate Guide to Becoming a Woman of Value on my website, thewomanofvalue.com. Just click the link at the top of the homepage. And if you haven't already done so, be sure to click the subscribe button in your listening app. And if there's something in this episode that inspired you, please share it with others, because the more we share these inspirational stories, the more women of value we will have in this world. I'll see you next time.